WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the Senate voted down a proposed amendment to the Constitution that would have given Congress and the states the power to prohibit the desecration of the flag. The idea for the amendment came after the Supreme Court ruled earlier in the month that flag burning is protected by the First Amendment. First Amendment issues have been in the headlines daily. Earlier this month, a record by the rap group Two Live Crew was ruled obscene by a federal judge in Florida. Three of the members of the group were arrested after a performance. And a Florida record store owner was arrested for selling the album. The visual arts world is also confronting charges of obscenity. This month, a Cincinnati gallery and its director were ordered to stand trial on obscenity charges for showing the works of the late Robert Mapplethorpe. It's the first time a gallery in the U.S. has faced prosecution for the content of the work it displayed. Congress is in the process of deciding whether to reauthorize the National Endowment for the Arts. Conservative and religious groups have accused the endowment of funding pornography and blasphemy. They're trying to block the renewal of the NEA or place restrictions on the content of the art the NEA would be allowed to fund. My guest David Cole is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and he's a professor of law at Georgetown Law Center. He was a co-counsel in the flag-burning cases that recently went before the Supreme Court. He's also worked with some of the artists and gallery directors who've been accused of obscenity, including David Wojnarowicz. I asked David Cole why he thinks certain records and art shows are under attack while live sex shows and pornography shops are being left alone.
That is a very blatant contradiction, and I think part of the issue is that in most cities, in most communities, through zoning standards, we have sort of excised and set to one side particular areas which traffic in live sex shows, et cetera. But artists and musicians are free to travel throughout the society. We don't have zoning codes that keep Two Live Crew in particular areas of town, or that keep Karen Finley or Annie Sprinkle from performing in major theaters around the country. And so these artists are really confronting audiences which may well include sort of mainstream people and people who are going to be offended, whereas by sort of excising out and keeping apart the sort of more traditional pornography, the society is able to sort of ignore it and say, sort of pretend that it doesn't exist. And I think that's why we're focusing, or the focus of the right wing has been on artists and singers rather than traditional pornographers. I also think that pornographers don't challenge the society and the society's values and mores in the same way that artists like David Wojnarowicz or Karen Finley or Two Live Crew do, because they sort of accept their role in society, and they play on very traditional sexual stereotypes and involving the submission of women, etc. And they don't attempt to challenge that. What people like David Wojnarowicz, Karen Finley, Annie Sprinkle, Two Live Crew do is really try to force people to confront their notions, their sort of stereotypical notions about sexuality, and that's much more threatening, I think, to the status quo than pornographers who, while they are explicit, very explicit in what they're doing, they accept certain basic notions of the status quo, and they sort of accept their role in the status quo.
The National Endowment for the Arts is up for reauthorization. In the past, this was always pretty routine. Suddenly, the National Endowment for the Arts is very controversial, and I wonder why you think funding of the arts has become such an important issue lately.
Well, I think that there's a general strategy that Jesse Helms has picked up on, and it started before the National Endowment for the Arts, and that is to focus on those areas where the government is funding expression, and to attempt to get his sort of his censorship effected through the funding mechanism, as opposed to through sort of straightforward prosecutions of expression. This is not the first Helms Amendment. The Helms Amendment, when people talk about the Helms Amendment today, they are generally referring to the attempt to limit the NEA's funding of artists. But the first Helms Amendment was an attempt to limit the content of federally funded AIDS education materials. And as you know, the federal government is a major funder of AIDS education around the country, the primary funder. And AIDS education consists largely of explaining to audiences who might be subject to getting AIDS, safe sex mechanisms for avoiding AIDS. And Jesse Helms passed an amendment to the provision of federal funding for that education, which said that no federally funded AIDS education materials could promote or encourage any homosexual sexual activity. Well, the whole point of AIDS education material is to encourage safe sex activity. And since the homosexual population is a particular target of the AIDS virus and a particular danger, the AIDS educators feel that it's critical to encourage people to adopt safe sex homosexual sexual activity. And Jesse Helms, because of his views about homosexuality, got an amendment passed which essentially deprived educators of the ability to educate people in the most effective way. And I think that what Jesse Helms has found is that if he does this through funding mechanisms, he can respond to the charges of censorship by saying, well, we're not censoring. All we're doing is saying how we want taxpayer dollars spent.
Well, what's wrong with that? Because, people who try to regulate funding, they say, we're not trying to say you can't say this. We're just saying the taxpayers are unwilling to support your saying this. They're unwilling to finance your saying this.
Right. Well, the problem with that is that the federal government has huge amounts of money and doles out very, very large amounts of money. And because of the resources that it commands, it has a major effect on the marketplace of ideas. And so if the federal government starts to say, we will pay people to say X and Y but not Z, then X and Y is what's going to be heard in the marketplace and not Z. And the courts have recognized for a long time that even where the government is doling out benefits subsidies, it cannot do so in a way which is designed to suppress dangerous ideas. And Jesse Helms clearly believes that homosexuality is a dangerous idea, and that's what he's attempting to suppress through the amendments that he's pushed for on the NEA, through the amendment that he pushed for on the and was successful in obtaining on the AIDS education program.
The National Endowment for the Arts currently has a letter of agreement that anybody getting funded by the NEA has to sign. And the agreement says that none of the funds may be used to promote, disseminate, or produce materials which in the judgment of the National Endowment for the Arts may be considered obscene, including but not limited to depictions of sadomasochism, homoeroticism, the sexual exploitation of children or individuals engaged in sex acts, and which, when taken as a whole, do not have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Do you have a problem with that letter of agreement?
Well, I think the problem, yes and no. I think the problem with the letter of agreement, and there are a number of problems. The first is that it is, it's very unclear, and I think it's very unclear because a political compromise was drawn to reach it. It talks about obscenity, but it doesn't include the actual legal definition of obscenity. It then goes on to list a whole series of specific acts like sadomasochism, homoeroticism, etc., which may or may not be obscene, depending on the context in which they are viewed. And it requires that the material not be obscene in the judgment of the NEA and not in the judgment of a court. So for someone who is signing that letter of agreement, it's very difficult to know what they are signing and what they are allowed to produce and what they aren't allowed to produce. They have to read the minds of the NEA. They have to sort of wade through a very confusing language. And the effect of that is that artists are very likely to chill themselves, and that people who are dependent upon this funding, particularly institutions that are dependent upon this funding, are not going to support or take on those artists who might in some way begin to approach the line of obscenity or offensive works.
As a constitutional lawyer, what do you think are some of the problems in evaluating what is obscene in the arts or in pop culture?
Well, the definition of obscenity is sort of a localized. It's both localized and national in scope. It's localized to the extent that it looks to community values for determining whether or not a work appeals solely to the prurient interest and violates community values. But it's national in the sense that it requires that only those works that have no serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value can be found to be obscene. And, you know, my sense is that that the NEA should not be and probably is not funding any work that is without any serious artistic value. So by definition, what the NEA does is fund works which have artistic value, and therefore, by definition, almost whatever it funds will not be obscene.
David Cole is my guest. He's a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Well, let's look at popular culture. Let's look at rap music, which is also at the center of controversy over issues of obscenity. The Two Live Crew record, As Nasty As They Want to Be, was the first recording declared obscene by a federal court. What do you think, as a constitutional lawyer, are some of the difficulties in evaluating what record is obscene?
Well, again, it comes down to whether or not it has serious artistic value. And many experts and critics have argued that the Two Live Crew record clearly has artistic value. It's it presents various forms of rap. It attempts to sort of build upon or parody various types of music. It uses traditional notions of traditional sort of artistic methods like hyperbole, exaggeration, metaphor. It is not, again, it's not hardcore pornography. It is artistic entertainment. And it clearly offended a federal judge in Florida who has ruled that it is legally obscene. But I'm fairly confident that on appeal that judgment will be reversed. I think it's be very, very hard to uphold something like rap music as obscene under the current definition by the Supreme Court.
Under the current Supreme Court definition of obscenity, a work has to be found prurient by an average member of the community. What is an average member of the community in a world that has become so multicultural that even in a county, right, you're going to have different ethnic groups, groups separated by taste according to gender, according to age? Whose community do we talk about when we talk about an average member of the community?
Well, that's definitely part of the difficulty. I mean, the Judge Justice Potter Stewart said that you know, at one point when the Supreme Court was trying to come up with a definition of obscenity, just threw up his hands and said, "I know it when I see it," and was unable and unwilling to try to reach for a more sort of objective test. And I think it is a very, very difficult thing to come up with an objective test. And I think the point about there being a wide degree of difference of perspective in any community is a very good one, and I think that's partly why these obscenity prosecutions are going forward. It's easy to be tolerant in a society where the overall social structures are such that they silence points of view which might be threatening to the mainstream. And I think for many years, the general social structure in this country was very adept at silencing homosexual points of view, silencing black points of view, silencing women's points of view. And in more recent times, While there are still great difficulties, and it's still a lot easier if you are in the mainstream to get your voice heard, there are emerging voices from all of those communities. And I think that what you're seeing is a reaction from the mainstream to these different voices and an attempt to suppress them as they had been suppressed in the past.
Because of the obscenity case against Two Live Crew, there are many record stores that aren't carrying the record anymore, even in places outside of the counties in which it's been declared obscene. Sam Goody's, for instance, the record chain, isn't stocking it anymore. What are your concerns about the effects on free speech that the declaration of the record as obscene and the arrest of the record store owner who sold the record in Florida might have?
Well, any obscenity prosecution has a ripple effect, and that's what you see in where record stores are not. I mean, if a chain like Sam Goody's, which is set in New York, where Two Live Crew would hardly be found to violate community standards, is nonetheless not selling the record because of their concerns about obscenity prosecutions, you see right there the kind of chilling effect, the ripple effect that a single obscenity prosecution can have. And I think that there are groups who push for obscenity prosecutions, and I don't think it's any coincidence that they push for them in those areas which are where community standards are most likely to be offended. With the ultimate effect of that being that through the ripple effect, through the chilling effect, all sorts of people in communities which may or may not be offended will be deprived the right to make their own choice. And that's the real problem here, is that the government, if the government starts prosecuting people for creating records, then the government is making a choice as to what people can or cannot hear. And ultimately, that should be the people's choice under the First Amendment to the Constitution.
In Florida, a record store owner faces charges for selling a Two Live Crew record. In Cincinnati, a gallery director faces charges for showing Robert Mapplethorpe's work. What kind of precedents do you think that these cases might set? What are your concerns here?
Well, what they're doing is they're going after the distributors. And so what will happen is that even, I think, artists are a pretty hardy sort and are used to controversy and are not so likely to be chilled by controversy. But distributors are, for the most part, in it as a business. And if they see threats to their business through being labeled, a pornographer, being labeled a purveyor of obscenity, I think they're going to be very reluctant to either sell these people's works or to, in the case of museums, to display these people's works. And so you're going to, I think, the ultimate effect is sort of cutting it off at the source where the art gets disseminated.
The NEA is up for reauthorization. Are there possible new amendments to the NEA that you're concerned about?
Yes, there are. Almost all of the amendments I'm concerned about, but I saw that there was an amendment offered about 2 weeks ago, which would have expanded the scope of what is forbidden from obscenity to language which criticizes a particular sector of American society. Last year, there was language which would have made it that Jesse Helms proposed and which passed the Senate 97-0, but ultimately did not succeed in getting into the final version of the bill, which would have made it unlawful for the NEA to fund any art which criticized the adherence or beliefs, the beliefs of adherence of a religion or non-religion, and I'm not sure what Jesse Helms meant by a non-religion, but read literally, a non-religion is everything other than religion. So any art which criticized anyone's beliefs would have not been permitted to be funded. So I think that any content restrictions are problematic. I think that If it were limited to the legal definition of obscenity, that is something without any artistic value, I think that would not be a grave problem as long as people understood how limited that definition really is.
Do you think that the NEA issue has any relevance for people who really aren't involved in the arts and don't much care about the visual arts?
Absolutely, and I you know you hear this that kind of argument about almost all of these cases, and that is, well, there's who listens to this kind of rap music anyway, and who wants to burn a flag anyway? It's only a small sector of society that is engaging in these types of activity or communication, or even listens to these types of communication, and therefore it really doesn't matter to the rest of the United States if we suppress those points of view. But that's precisely what the First Amendment was designed to stop. Well, the framers of our Constitution understood that it's very natural for a community to attempt to suppress those who are without power, those who are weakest in the society. And so the First Amendment was designed to protect the unpopular, to protect those who are marginalized. And so when we start to suppress the points of view of those on the margins, everybody is threatened. And you can't start drawing lines. I mean, we saw it during the McCarthy era. Everybody said, well, they're just going after the communists, and the Communist Party is an incredibly small party in the United States. And that expanded to, they're just going after people who aren't loyal, who won't take loyalty oaths, et cetera. And ultimately, many, many people were blacklisted, and many people's lives were ruined by this type of witch hunting and suppression. So I think it really does threaten all of us in our daily lives. And it really, the biggest threat is the threat to the principle for which our community is supposed to stand, our national community is supposed to stand, and that is toleration of different points of view, whether we agree with them or not.
Well, David Cole, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
David Cole is a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR National Public Radio.